Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And insurance agent Dan Williamson of Bill Resch Insurance, offering comprehensive auto, business, and home coverage in affiliation with Pekin Insurance. Beyond the expected. More at 812-336-6838. From WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
I think it has to be put in the context of interest in low-carb diets, for one thing, where, you know, you're really eliminating things like bread from your diet.
This week, Alex Chambers talks with Andrea Wiley and Krista Vorel about gluten and why so many people seem to be avoiding it. Harvest Public Media updates us on farmers dealing with flooding in Nebraska. We've got a mint julep recipe for Derby Day and a story about a push to decriminalize psychedelic mushrooms. All that in the next half hour on Earth Eats. First, a couple of news items. What you got, Alex?
Hi, Kate. Farm equipment sales fell by $900 million in the first 3 months of this year, the biggest decline since 2016. Pat Westhoff is an agricultural economist at the University of Missouri. He says the biggest factor for the drop is the ongoing Trump administration's trade war and the resulting tariffs on U.S. ag products. But he says it's not the only reason.
As important as the trade deals are to be able to move forward successfully, just the weather this spring will have a lot to do with where things come out in the future, as will the health of the general economy.
Westhoff says all farmers eventually will have to replace aging tractors and combines, so it's a matter of time until the numbers rebound. But until then, he says farmers will be less efficient and productive while they rely on old machines and don't take advantage of new technologies. For the last four decades, the USDA has refused to share data on SNAP purchases at individual stores. Health advocates want that information to be public. They say it will help analysts understand issues surrounding nutrition and access to food across the country. A case on the Supreme Court docket this session could force the agency's hand. In November 2016, a district court decided in favor of the Argus Leader, a newspaper in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, after the paper requested USDA data on SNAP sales through the Freedom of Information Act. In 2017, the USDA began to comply with the decision. Then a trade association, the Food Marketing Institute, stepped in and asked the U.S. Court of Appeals to reverse the decision. The group lost. But now they've taken their case to the Supreme Court, arguing that the data amounts to trade secrets that deserve protection. The Supreme Court is expected to make a decision this summer. And that's the news. Thanks to Harvest Public Media and Chad Bouchard for those stories.
Thanks for that, Alex.
Sure thing, Kate.
Farmers and ranchers who've been dealing with the fallout from Missouri River flooding have also been grappling with low commodity prices, trade tariffs, and high property taxes. In a business that requires a lot of faith and hard work, it's not easy for some operations to pay the bills, much less turn a profit in the current agricultural environment. For Harvest Public Media, Jack Williams has more.
Flood water went right through our place here, and it took a gully right out of the middle of the place. Our water lines for our cattle are laid right there, and it took the water line right out of the ground.
As Tom Geisler trudges through the mud on his farm in Hupper in northeast Nebraska, all he can see is a big mess. He grows corn and soybeans on 1,000 acres in this small town, but high water from the March floods wrecked pretty much everything.
Never seen anything like this before. Never even had water in the yard here before on the place. It's just been deep and devastating. And then one thing that was really bad was the ice cakes floating down and just cut everything to pieces.
Geisler has been at this for more than 40 years and is a fifth-generation farmer. It's in his blood, but things haven't been easy lately. With low prices for corn and soybeans, property taxes close to $100 an acre, and now this.
Always been up and downs ever since I've been farming. My dad always said the same thing, just watch out for the bad years and prepare for it because you're going to have them no matter what.
It's a common story in Nebraska and across the Midwest, especially in Iowa and Missouri. Net farm income has been down for a while, and many farmers and ranchers have more debt than they did a few years ago. Tina Barrett is the president of Lincoln-based Nebraska Farm Business and helps Midwest producers navigate tough financial times.
Everything's been kind of crazy for a while, and coming off of a significant price decline over the last few years and adjusting to that, now we're dealing with the flooding in significant areas of Nebraska. And all of those things are kind of coming into play and creating an unknown for 2019 that we haven't seen in a while.
Those unknowns can be stressful on farmers and ranchers who have built their lives around their crops and livestock.
This last year, we set four new all-time monthly highs for the most new first-time high-stress phone callers.
John Hansen is the president of the Nebraska Farmers Union and has been part of the Rural Response Hotline since it started in 1984. Farmers and ranchers can call the number for mental health resources and other assistance during tough times. Hansen says many ag producers in a hole financially have a hard time admitting they're failing.
It's their identity, it's their inheritance, it's their legacy. It's all of these things in addition to being a high-risk, capital-intensive, low-margin business.
Across the Midwest, farm bankruptcies jumped 19% last year. Creighton University economist Ernie Goss says many farmers entered this downturn in a pretty good place financially after a run of high commodity prices a few years ago. And he says there will always be a demand for their products, despite the recent slowdown.
There's one thing we all need, and that's food, and that's globally. It doesn't matter if you're in China, India, France, or Germany, wherever.
Steve Nelson, the president of the Nebraska Farm Bureau, says there are reasons to feel optimistic, but
it could be that it'll take a year or two before they understand that they can't come back from this kind of loss.
Back at Tom Geisler's farm, he's fixing and saving what he can. It's a big mess, but he's optimistic.
Yeah, you just have to be resilient and keep going, and hopefully it'll work out for us this year. At least something. Hopefully we'll have a good crop, but nobody knows that except God, so.
Surrounded by a landscape he hardly recognizes, he pauses to look around a scene of mud and destruction.
Someday, hopefully, you can get it back to the way it was. It's going to be a while.
For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jack Williams.
HarvestPublicMedia.org is the place to go for more stories on food and farming in the heartland. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent providing customized financial services for individuals, businesses, and disabled adults, including tax planning, bill paying, and estate services. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Bill Brown at Griffey Creek Studio, architectural design and consulting for residential, commercial, and community projects. Sustainable, energy positive, and resilient design for a rapidly changing world. Bill at GriffeyCreek.studio. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
So, Kate, you eat gluten.
Yeah.
I know this partly because you make incredible pies.
Yeah, pie.
And also, you may remember that we used to teach a bread class together.
That's right. Can't make bread without gluten.
Nope, you can't. Do you know a lot of people who are avoiding gluten?
Yes, a lot of people.
It's like it's just kind of crazy to me how many people I know who are avoiding it. My mom, my brother. I was in New York a couple of weeks ago and visiting with a couple of childhood friends, and both of them are avoiding it. One of them said to me, "You remember how I used to be lactose intolerant?" I was like, "Yeah, I actually do remember that." He was like, "It turns out I got tests a while back and I'm actually gluten intolerant, not lactose intolerant."
Oh, wow. Well, it can be hard when you're a baker and your friends and family don't eat gluten.
It's a real bummer.
Yeah.
Although it's probably more of a bummer for the people who can't eat it.
Yeah. And I do wonder what's going on with that, just the increase.
Yeah, I know. It's really interesting. I've been wanting to figure it out, too. So I talked with Andrea Wiley, who's been on the show before, and Krista Vorel, who's collaborating with her to try to answer that question.
Great. What'd they find out?
It's complicated.
I figured.
Yeah. So there's celiac disease, which is an immune reaction to gluten, affects about 1% of the population. But you don't have to have celiac, of course, to have a problem with wheat. Enough people have been feeling better without wheat that sales of gluten-free products almost quadrupled between 2011 and 2015. So many people are avoiding gluten that some doctors have started warning their patients against a gluten-free diet if they don't have celiac, because sometimes it means replacing whole grains with more highly refined starches like potatoes and tapioca and rice.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, but other people feel like those doctors are discounting their own experiences of feeling better off of wheat. So that's what I was trying to understand when I invited Krista and Andrea into the studio. So if you could each just start out by introducing yourselves.
I'll start. My name is Krista Vorel, and I'm a senior at IU and a Cox Research Scholar. And I've been working with Dr. Wiley now. This will be my fourth year on our gluten project.
Great.
Oh, yeah. So I'm Andrea Wiley. I'm a professor of anthropology here at IU. I am a biological anthropologist, so I'm interested in human evolution and human biological variation. My particular interests are in the role that diet has played in shaping human evolution and human variation.
Andrea Wiley's been on Earth Eats before, talking about her research on milk. But whereas the main problem with milk is lactose intolerance, it seems to be more complicated with wheat.
There's a spectrum of wheat intolerances, and there are three kind of major categories. There's celiac disease, which is like an autoimmune disease. So when you consume gluten, your immune system essentially starts to attack the cells of your small intestine, and eventually it destroys them. So that is one end of the spectrum. There's wheat allergy as well, which is also immunologically driven, but it is mediated by a different part of the immune system, the IgE system. And it's the mechanism is similar to any kind of food allergy. And that's not particularly common. It's more common among kids, as are most food allergies. And then there's this other category that is called non-celiac gluten sensitivity.
Yes. Some researchers have also considered adapting the name to non-celiac wheat sensitivity, but you can also kind of run into problems there because wheat is not the only gluten-containing grain. Mm-hmm. Also, popular gluten-containing grains are barley and rye.
So we've seen that celiac itself has actually increased, and it's not just due to better diagnosis. There was that study where they took the blood samples, I think,
from
right?
The Army recruits.
That were taken in, what, the 50s? Mm-hmm. And saw that the rates of celiac in their blood samples was way lower than what we're finding in similar populations now. So celiac is on the rise.
Well, when you look at celiac on its own, and for example, in that study of Army recruits, it can seem really alarming. But when you look at it within the context of other autoimmune diseases are also on the rise at the same or similar rates as celiac disease. Yeah.
That's or at least it's part of the package, right? So the question then becomes, why are autoimmune diseases in general on the rise? And, you know, there are a number of hypotheses for that. I would say, you know, thinking about more of the cultural stuff as well, I think it has to be put in the context of interest in low-carb diets, for one thing, that begin kind of in the 80s and 90s with Atkins at the start, where, you know, you're really eliminating things like bread from your diet. And some people report great success in removing carbohydrates from their diet. And now that has kind of transformed into the keto diet. And then, of course, there's a paleo diet. And all these diets would eschew wheat, right, or grains of most kinds. And there's probably some conflation in people's minds about gluten and carbohydrates, right, that, oh, well, bread is carbohydrates, and I've also heard it's got gluten in it, and so collectively those things become things that you can eliminate from your diet if you're trying to achieve weight loss, for example.
The number of people avoiding gluten has turned out to be a big market opportunity. I mentioned to Andrea and Krista that by 2020, the sales of gluten-free products are projected to be almost $24 billion.
Yeah, that seems an incomprehensible number. So clearly,
someone's buying them.
Right. Whether they are self-diagnosed as or otherwise diagnosed as gluten sensitive, perhaps there is a larger sense that maybe gluten is something to be avoided. And hence, you know, given a choice between two products, one that doesn't have the gluten-free label and one that does, I choose the gluten-free one because it carries some kind of health halo. And so it must be. I didn't know that gluten was bad, but if it doesn't have it, then that seems good. It's not an uncommon marketing ploy when it comes to food labeling.
Yeah, I mean, that health halo goes beyond food. The shampoo that I use is like a sort of eco-friendly shampoo, and it's gluten-free also, apparently.
Yeah, so it's, you know, clearly gluten has some cultural currency right now and some real currency. Yeah. You know, one of the things the wheat industry says is, and it's true in my limited experience, is that gluten-free products are more expensive. And so we want to be careful. You know, there are probably lots of people out there consuming gluten-free foods who don't need to be. So they're essentially wasting their money. Again, that's the wheat industry's line in this. Obviously, they have an interest in minimizing this and eager to see this trend perhaps go away.
But while the popularity of gluten-free diets suggests it's just the latest diet fad, a lot of people are experiencing discomfort, and researchers are trying to figure out why. One of those questions is whether the problem is the gluten itself or something else.
Yeah, so there are other components of wheat that people seem to be sensitive to as well. There are enzymes in wheat that seem to trigger intolerant symptoms. There are also these
carbohydrates as well.
Yeah, there's this whole category of, what would you call them, food constituents called FODMAPs, which are basically sugar molecules of varying sizes and complexity.
FODMAP, by the way, stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols, in case you were wondering. Okay, back to Andrea.
And wheat has a number of those as well. And FODMAPs have been shown to have some of the same symptomatology as gluten intolerance. And there are a number of studies where if you take people who say they're gluten intolerant and reduce their FODMAP consumption, that they actually get better, even when you reintroduce gluten. So there is some confusion about whether gluten is, it surely is, but is it the only constituent of wheat that is bothersome?
And another reason it's hard to figure out whether it's gluten or FODMAPs or something else is that the only way to figure out whether someone has non-celiac gluten sensitivity is by how they report their symptoms.
Right now, there is no biomarker for non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So they, you know, that is one of the key problems in the field right now is there's no established marker for it. So it's really all done by, well, if you take gluten out of someone's diet, do they report feeling better? And then it becomes very important to run, you know, a double-blind placebo study so that people aren't simply reporting, well, yeah, I removed gluten and I'm feeling great. And those studies that have kind of looked at FODMAPs versus gluten in a blinded way have found in some cases that the FODMAPs are the problem and that when people are eating gluten and not knowing it, they're actually doing okay. For some studies, other studies show the opposite. And so the evidence isn't all converging at this point, which makes for a very messy kind of science right now.
And it's not just the hard science that's making it complicated.
A strand of this, too, is this like trust in science and skepticism of science. And I think we're at a particular moment in our history where, you know, that is really kind of coming to a head. And I always find it kind of interesting, you know, in a political sense, I have many colleagues who will defend science and its benefits against the current skepticism, but have their own kind of, I think, again, we are our own experiments. And so in my, like, I have this particular experience, it doesn't match up with the science. And so what am I trying to say here? I privilege my own experience over the science. And that's fair in some respect. Science only tells you about probabilities of things. They don't tell you about experiments of one. And I think gluten is a good example where, you know, skepticism and science kind of ride skepticism of the science, skepticism of this as a real phenomenon, are present with science trying to figure out what this is.
In other words, it's really hard to tease out the cultural aspects of this from the biological ones. Are we thinking we're feeling better because we've been hearing for decades that carbs are bad for us? Is there something about our immune systems that are having more trouble dealing with wheat than we used to? Or is there something different about the wheat itself? There's good evidence for all of these things, even though they seem like they would cancel each other out. What's to be done? Well, one thing I would say is don't pay too much attention to individual studies. As Andrea pointed out, they're pretty quick to contradict each other. When you can, eat whole grains. There's consensus on that. As for wheat and gluten and FODMAPs, do what works for you. The research is probably going to converge eventually. The scientists and the anthropologists are on it. For Earth Eats, I'm Alex Chambers.
Psychedelic mushrooms were federally banned back in the 1970s, along with a host of other hallucinogens. Now, a growing movement wants to access this fungi for medicinal use. Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports that mushroom enthusiasts seek the freedom to take them without fear of criminal prosecution.
Euphoria, hallucinations, seeing God are all side effects of psilocybin mushrooms, which people consume sometimes in a tea, as a chocolate, or in tiny doses, also called microdosing. And these mushrooms grow all over the world.
These right here, I picked like 3 days ago.
Like here, in this closet in a Denver apartment. Douglas, who didn't want to use his full name for fear of federal prosecution, holds a handful of mushrooms that he grows and sells illegally.
Mushrooms are really easygoing, especially psilocybin. You know, they kind of just grow themselves, and like this is a relatively quiet thing to do.
With his DIY setup of glass jars, large plastic bins, and a pressure cooker, Douglas can grow up to $1,000 of mushrooms per month. He learned how on the internet. Companies will even ship mushroom spores in the mail, which is legal since they don't contain psilocybin.
If you just want to start small, investment super low, you could throw $80 at it and have like an ounce to yourself.
But doing so could land you in prison, which is why a ballot measure in Denver's upcoming election asks voters to decriminalize mushrooms. Adults 21 or older who are caught with it or even growing the fungi for themselves would be a low priority for local police.
With decriminalization and stuff, I can operate a little bit more freely, have to worry less.
And it's not just Denver. A Republican lawmaker in Iowa recently proposed removing psilocybin from the state's list of controlled substances. And in Oregon, a campaign hopes to legalize it for medical use in approved clinics.
This isn't the stuff that states have any infrastructure to deal with.
Matthew Johnson has spent the last 15 years researching psychedelics at Johns Hopkins University. He says research shows this drug is not addictive, causes fewer ER visits compared to other illegal drugs, and could be used to treat a whole host of ailments, like depression. But he doesn't support increasing access in the same way some states have loosened up laws around cannabis.
You know, there are substantial risks involved with this therapy, and it needs to be done by appropriately trained and credentialed medical and psychological professionals.
Under the influence of psilocybin, people can panic and put themselves in danger. There have been fatalities.
I would hope that Denver would be very clear about, yes, there are risks, and these are the risks. There are harms that can come from this. This isn't encouragement to use.
In as little as 5 years, Johnson believes research on psilocybin will lead to the first FDA-approved medication, at which point the federal government will have to stop treating it like a dangerous drug. But until then...
Any controlled substance is a concern. It's obviously on a Schedule 1 for a reason.
Deanne Reuter is with the DEA office in Denver and says they'll continue prosecuting psilocybin cases, even though they don't see that many.
The trafficking of psilocybin seems to be like a small niche kind of community.
Like Douglas, who says he doesn't have a lot of competition and knows most of the people he sells to. And even though the Denver ballot measure wouldn't protect a dealer like him, he wants to grow more.
I'd say half of it is supplementary income, whereas the other half is like, I want to create something that people can benefit from.
He says anything that breaks down the stigma around mushrooms will be good for business. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
You can find more from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. It's Derby weekend. Kentucky Derby, that is. Earth Eats founder and former host Annie Corrigan shares a recipe for classic mint juleps from Chef Daniel Orr.
Got some great mint out of the garden, and we're going to take off most of the stem. And what we want is that real nice green color. It's going to be a real bright, vibrant kind of chartreuse color.
And again, you grow many, many types of mint. What kind of mint in particular?
Spearmint would be great for this. Peppermint. This is the apple mint. Okay, then I've made some simple syrup, and we've done syrups before on Earth Eats. Equal parts sugar and water. We're going to add, for two people, we'll add about a third of a cup. We're going to put about an equal part of bourbon. Now, you don't want to use your really good bourbon because the mint's going to cover up all the subtleties of the aging process and the barrel aging and all that. So not exactly rot gut, but one step above. And now we're going to put a squeeze of a lime in there, and really you want to squeeze it out, get all that juice and get that pith in there. And then one thing that I like to do is to go ahead and just cut off a little bit of that lime zest and throw that in there, and it's going to be a little bit chunky when we puree it with the ice cubes, but it tastes so good to bite into those little pieces of zest. We've got all of our ingredients there. We're going to top it off with some ice, put it on the machine, and here we go.
Now all we need is a very large, beautiful Sunday church straw hat.
Some flowers tucked in it. There you go. I think it looked better on you than me, though. Here you go. Have a sip all right. And let me know what you think.
Cheers.
Cheers.
That's the most refreshing drink that I could imagine having on a hot, hot day as I'm outside.
One mint julep, who was the cause of it all?
That's it for Earth Eats this week. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to the Earth Eats team, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Josephine McRobbie, Daniel Orr, Renee Reed, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Andrea Wiley, Krista Vorrell, and Annie Corrigan. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I produce the show. We'll be back next week. Production support comes from insurance agent Dan Williamson of Bill Resch Insurance, offering comprehensive auto, business, and home coverage in affiliation with Pekin Insurance. Beyond the expected. More at 812-336-6838. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And Bill Brown at Griffey Creek Studio, architectural design and consulting for residential, commercial, and community projects. Sustainable, energy-positive, and resilient design for a rapidly changing world. Bill at GriffeyCreek.studio.